This episode of Just Imagine is proudly supported by Dragonfly Books, a community-oriented bookstore with thousands of titles at 112 West Water Street in downtown Decorah, including many books on peace and justice-related topics, also offering online ebooks through their website at dragonflybooks.com. Thanks to Dragonfly Books for all their support.
Good afternoon. Mike Blevins here, your host for Just Imagine. You're listening to 89.1 FM, The Blend. Community radio from Northeast Iowa. It's beginning to cloud up on this beautiful November day. We are expecting a little bit of moisture, I hear. That's an understatement. So this is the time when, at least for the last four winters, we have been on the threshold of 7 months of snow. This is the Community Peace and Justice Hour that comes to you weekly, 4 o'clock to 5 o'clock on Monday afternoons on your community truly independent radio, 89.1 FM, The Blend. I hope you had a good weekend. We have a special Veterans Day show with a couple of guests, and we're looking forward to speaking with our very special friend, Bob Watson, a veteran of the Vietnam War. And also late in the hour, we hope to speak with Hannah Breckbill about her recent experience in Ontario, working with indigenous peoples in there that are struggling up there. That, I guess north is up, I don't, you know, not really. But she worked with a Christian Peacemakers team, a fairly radical peace and human rights organization that you may have heard about in Iraq. Early before the invasion of Iraq, Christian Peacemaker teams were there, and one of their members was killed being a witness for peace. And Hannah's been involved, her family's been involved in Christian Peacemaker teams for years. Her grandfather is actually one of the founders of the group, and she's on the board of the Northeast Iowa Peace and Justice Show. She will be here hopefully the last 10 minutes, if she can make it from work, to tell us about her program on Thursday night. So until then, we'll hold that thought and welcome our guest, Bob Watson. Bob, welcome.
Thank you.
It's great to have you with us. We're on a roll. We've had you on the show now twice in the last 6 weeks. You are busy helping Iowans pay attention to how to take care of land, water, and air. And we welcome you this evening, or late this afternoon, on a different measure. During our last show, the show that you were our guest on a few weeks ago, at the very end, I kind of threw a curveball at you. I didn't prepare you for it. I thanked you for your Vietnam service.
Mm-hmm.
And you weren't aware that I was aware that you were a veteran. And that began a conversation between us, and we've worked out your being on the show again today.
Yeah, that we'd have a conversation about that.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So we look forward to hearing your take on the military, on war and peace, on the role of all of these difficult issues of the military and conflict and international fights,
mm-hmm.
how we can resolve them.
Mm-hmm.
I want to, before we delve into that important subject, just have a brief word about what occurred this weekend in Decorah. We had an Occupy Decorah event organized by Nicole Harris from Postville, and she was assisted by the Northeast Iowa Peace and Justice Center, and it was a very meaningful event by all reports. And we wanted to play a few minutes of a report filed by
KPVL,
and we thank our host station here for doing an audio report. I can't recall an audio report by a local station at an event like this in some time. So I'm excited. And here it is.
On November 5th at 1 p.m., about 40 concerned citizens gathered at the Decorah Courthouse to participate in a peaceful demonstration that they called Occupy Decorah, a name borrowed from a larger organization known as Occupy Wall Street, or Occupy Together. Occupy encourages people to join their own community's Occupy group, or, in the case that a community doesn't have a group, to create their own. 22-year-old Nicole Harris of Postville did just that, and she organized this, Occupy Decorah's first demonstration. Here she is now to explain how and why she did this.
I was talking to my friend online, and I was like, I wish there was an Occupy Decorah because I can't afford to make it to any of the other bigger ones. And we just started talking, and I was like, well, I'm going to make a group and invite people. And then it just blew up from there.
During the demonstration, several attendees stood on the steps leading to the courthouse to express their political views. One of these people was Jim Tripp, a Spanish teacher living in Decorah. Here he is reading the Declaration of the Occupation of New York City.
As we gather today in solidarity to express a feeling of mass injustice, we must not lose sight of what brought us together. We write so that all people who feel wronged by the corporate forces of the world can know that we are your allies.
After he spoke, Tripp explained to me why he attended the demonstration.
By being here today, I want to join with other citizens of Decorah and Iowa and our county and start talking about what we need to fix, how we can fix it, how we can join our forces and make things better.
Here's 66-year-old Lynn Sutherin explaining why she attended Occupy Decorah.
I feel strongly that our country has taken a huge step in the wrong direction in terms of how it handles money. I think that the problems we are having economically have been caused almost exclusively by speculation by moneyed interests like banking, and secondly, by the politicians who are being bought by them. I think that the middle class and the poor are being misused and forced to pay for these people's mistakes.
Members of Occupy Decorah agreed to meet at the courthouse again this Saturday, November 12th at 1 p.m. I'm Josh Bacon, reporting for KPVL.
Go Josh, I love that report. And the numbers actually increased. There were some who had to come and go. So I think at any one time we had about 40 there, but I think about 60 attended. So we're real grateful for everyone. And as Josh pointed out, Nikki led sort of a brief general assembly, and a decision was made to meet weekly at 1 o'clock. Bob, Veterans Day is this Friday, November 11th. Can you give us a bit of just a brief history of what the heck Veterans Day is? I think a lot of listeners in Northeast Iowa are very familiar with it. Some, it's just a day on the calendar.
Yeah, well, it originally was Armistice Day, which was the end of World War I. And, but since the wars didn't stop and we continue to be involved in them, we renamed it Veterans Day. It's pretty easy for me to remember because it's actually the day after the Marine Corps birthday. And as a former Marine, there are probably 95% or 96% former Marines that actually celebrate the birthday. Even the special remembrance of Tom Keith the other night on Minnesota Public Radio had a lot of references to Tom being a former Marine. So I actually celebrate the birthday. And then the next day is Veterans Day, so it kind of reminds me that Veterans Day is there. So,
just a side note, I was not in the military, but my dad was in the Marine Corps and a veteran of the Korean War. Although he didn't see combat, He was a short, skinny little kid who was smart. No, he didn't fit school. And he lied about his age. That's how he got in the Marine Corps. And
yeah, there were a lot of 17-year-old kids in the rice paddies with me, too.
He was assigned to the USS Montrose, a transport ship taking troops back and forth to Korea. He was the only Marine on that ship. And he actually had a very special experience. He had never been outside the state of Kansas before joining the Marines. And the people he got to know, the places he saw, the issues that were being dealt with at that time. He interacted with troops on the way, and with some of those, of course, who were veterans of the conflict of the war as they returned. And not just returned to the United States, but also folks who were going for R&R to Japan.
Mm-hmm.
That's just where I'm coming from on this. Give us a little bit of your how did you end up in the Marines? Why did you go to the Marines? How did you end up on that track in your life?
Actually, I had a full ride to Iowa State on an academic scholarship in 1966 and didn't like school after being at school for 13 years. Mm-hmm. And so I decided to quit and join the service. Well, I was afraid of the water because I can't swim growing up in Northeast Iowa. And I didn't want to be part of the Army. And so I decided to join the Marine Corps like my Uncle Bob Watson. So obviously the people that gave me all the scholarships to have a full ride at Iowa State didn't actually know what they were talking about, because 1966 was not a good time to be joining the Marine Corps. There was actually something going on that the Marines were taking part in. It's kind of interesting, though, that there's a lot of Peace Corps people in this town. Mm-hmm. And they had one of their first potlucks probably 20 years ago or something like that. And Linda and I were invited. And so they all stood around in a circle, and they were telling each other about where they had been and you know, when and that sort of thing. And when it got to me, I said, well, I'm part of the War Corps, and without me, you guys wouldn't have a job. So
yeah.
There are these odd little things that you can actually bring up that put things into context, out of context, mm-hmm. Which is kind of, what happened when we had our interchange the last time I was on. I understand what that kind of thing is, thanking people for their service.
Mm-hmm.
It seems a little bit hard for me to be a part of that because all of our wars after Korea from 1954 on have actually been illegal and immoral invasions and occupations. And how you can then honor someone for being part of an illegal, immoral occupation and invasion is a little bit confusing to me, especially, since I'm one of the people that was the occupier and invader. So the Marine Corps, takes you places and puts you into situations that if you live through, you can actually use at some point to discuss with people in your own society what all that stuff means, what it means to be in a society. I mean, it's fairly apropos now. The Occupy movement, as far as I'm concerned, is a pretty good thing to be happening. I listened the other evening to the originator, the Canadian who originated this, and he's thinking that this is a watershed event, that it doesn't necessarily have to happen all at once now, but he feels that there's some very big changes that are going to happen. I think that the Vietnam War that I took part in, and the people that both prosecuted that war like I did, and protested that war, like I did after I came back, were also part of a pretty big game-changing time in our country.
Yeah.
I've always been confused at people who deny that they really had anything to do with the 60s. And usually that's like saying they didn't smoke dope or something, you know. Everybody was Bill Clinton who inhaled or who was in the room but didn't actually inhale. But to deny that, that the Vietnam War, the 1960s, the civil rights, all of the stuff that was going on, the beginnings of the feminist movement, is something that they didn't have anything to do with or didn't, you know, they grew out of it or whatever is to me a fairly strange kind of a reflection back on who you might be or how you got to be who you are, either as an individual or as a society.
Now, in 1954, I was born. And so in 66, when you entered the Marines, I was 12 years old. I just wanted to point that out.
Mm-hmm.
For you, Bob.
Mm-hmm.
Kid. Yeah. And I looked at your at the folk. I'm as the crest of the baby boom. Folks born in about my time looked at those who were involved with the war, with the growing protests over the war, with the civil rights movement, including women's rights and LGBT rights, our jaws dropped in the 60s. I mean, it was absolutely, there's no question. There was a charge in the air. There was energy. There was a turning of the cultural soil. The question was, of course, which side of the hoe you were on, and how vested you were in with things the way they institutionally and usually were. And part of my appreciation for you is the realization that I just missed what had to be hell. I'm curious to know from your point of view whether or not actually going to Vietnam was a nightmare or not.
Yeah, well, actually, I was more afraid of going to jail than I was of going to Vietnam, and so that's probably the reason I didn't go to Canada. It was the known versus the unknown,
yeah.
Basically. I had been in for 2.5 years before I got orders. I got out of boot camp and went for more combat training, and then I went to school. And which was apropos to the Marine Corps at the time, I went to a school that was already obsolete. The Marine Corps didn't use that stuff that I went to school for, which is something to say about the Marine Corps. And then I went, and I actually put in for OCS, and orders came in. But by the time the orders for officer candidate school came in, I had been selected to play on the varsity baseball team for the Marine Corps, so I wasn't where the orders came. And so I was...
Hold it just a minute.
Yeah.
What position did you play?
I played...
This is an unknown fact. I doubt very many of our listeners that even know you know about this.
Yeah, well, I played bench.
Oh.
There were 16 signed professionals on the baseball team
that
I played
right?
on. Yeah, well, that was back when you could still...
Any names
in.
You can drop?
David Frost pitched for the Angels for probably 11 or 12 years, and we actually got thrown off the base together. We couldn't drive our cars onto the base, so we walked back and forth to our barracks.
This must have been something the Marine Corps, at least subconsciously, encouraged, because my dad ditched a Jeep, airborne from a bridge, and he and his passenger were very graced to survive it. It was airborne, rolled, turned, and they lived.
Yeah. So I'd been in the Marine Corps for quite a while before I got orders. I got orders when I was Marine Corps Recruit Depot in San Diego. And they were like probably... I don't know, 3,000 or 4,000 people on that base, and I was the only person that fit the orders. And so I ended up going to Vietnam then.
So that was?
1969. So I'd been in the Marine Corps for, no, let's see, 1969. I'd been in the Marine Corps for 2.5 years.
Okay.
And then I got my orders, and like I say, I was too scared to go to Canada and too afraid of jail, so I actually went over to Vietnam. It was interesting to me. It actually took me about 20 years to find out that not all Marines did what I did in Vietnam.
And what was that?
I was out in the bush the whole time, basically. So I was basically getting shot at every day.
How long?
It was 11 months and 10 days. And so even when I was in the hospital, I was getting rocketed. But I thought that because I had that experience, I thought that all Marines had that experience. And it took me a long time to figure out that it is true that only about 10% of the people in a war zone actually fight the war. Well, I didn't really realize that. And so there were a lot of things that I had been dealing with in Vietnam. I understood. I had been in the Marine Corps long enough to know that there were some real problems about Vietnam. I mean, I was just a small-town kid from Strawberry Point, and I didn't really know a whole lot about the world. But after 2.5 years of mostly living in California, that was a pretty good place to be during those times, you actually figured out that there were things that were pretty wrong with what was going on. Well, so I ended up in Vietnam, and the first day I was there, I wasn't gone to where I was going to be yet. And a guy that I had known in the States beforehand was running a little bar, and so I was in there drinking. And he said, "Where are you going?" I said, "Well, I'm going down to Anwa tomorrow." And he goes, "Oh, Rocket City South." And I said, "Really, what's that mean?" He said, "You'll find out." So basically the next day I got on a helicopter and flew down to Anwa. And as the helicopter was landing, mortars were coming in onto the LZ. And so it was taking off. I had to jump off. And basically that was my introduction to Vietnam. And it went downhill from there. Yeah.
Wow.
Yeah. So, like I say, that part was pretty intense. And it lasted for a year. The Marine Corps actually did a study, a statistical study. And people like me that spent a year in Vietnam without getting shot, so basically spent the whole time in combat, saw the same amount of combat as a person that went through the whole Second World War. You just didn't have the long breaks in between.
Uh-huh.
So besides the combat, we had all of the sleep deprivation, all of that stuff. It was just constant. It was 24/7, 7 days a week for basically just short of a year for me. And so what that does is it actually makes you think a lot of stuff. So like I say, if you're lucky enough to live through it, it allows you a baseline, experiential baseline, in order to look at and discuss with other people in your society about how the hell did you let me get there in the first place. And like I said before, when I think I might have said it, all of our wars since 1954 have basically been illegal and immoral.
Yeah, that means there have not been declarations of war. There have been international conventions violated. Non-aggression pacts, non-aggression provisions and international covenants ignored. Preemptive doctrine was formalized early in the Bush administration and acted upon in the fraud that took us into Iraq.
Well, it's all
just to mention a few
things. Yeah, it's all been like that. I mean, actually, I used 1954 because that's when the French were defeated at Dien Bien Phu. But because of the de Gaulle's stricture or restriction that there could be no Marshall Plan in France unless we provided ships and transport and materiel for the French to retake French Indochina, We actually were involved at the CIA's level, and so when the French were defeated in 1954 at Dien Bien Phu, we were already there, so we just took it over. I served with Marines who served in Vietnam in the 1950s, and we didn't say we were there until 1965, although we had some advisors there. And the other thing about it, it's not only been illegal and immoral wars, but they've all been our allies. I mean, we actually made a deal with Ho Chi Minh and his Nationalist Party that if they would fight the Japanese, we would recognize their independence. There are pictures that we have showing the OSS officer, station chief of Vietnam, on the platform with Ho Chi Minh during their Declaration of Independence Day ceremony. And actually, their Declaration of Independence was taken almost verbatim from Jefferson, from ours. And so the Vietnamese were our allies. The Panamanians were our allies. Iraq, Saddam Hussein, the CIA first hired him in 1957 or 58 as an assassin. And we helped the Ba'ath Party come to power in Iraq through a coup. Afghanistan, we actually, this was Henry Kissinger wanting the Russians, the Soviets, to have their own Vietnam. Our CIA actually assassinated not only the Russian ambassador to Afghanistan, but the ambassador's family. Mm-hmm. And so then we knew that the Russians would come in. We armed and funded all of the horrible groups that were now either fighting or arming and funding in Afghanistan. And so it's since 1954, we have only fought those people that we created, whether or not it was Vietnam, Panama, Iraq, Afghanistan. And there's probably another one I'm missing somewhere. I'm not sure. So that brings me to the point where how can you actually say thank you for your service when you understand that service has been a hollow service?
Do you feel guilty about it?
No. Actually, there's a distinction that can be made. Yeah. There's an interdistinction and an intra-war.
Could you help our listeners?
Sure.
Understand that?
The people that I'm not very happy with are the people in my society that have allowed this to happen and have taken part in having this happen, and so those people I really don't like. And I don't like how our country goes about doing that kind of stuff. But when I get with other combat veterans, we have done something that is pretty major as far as being a human being. We have taken part in a struggle, as a lot of people around the world have to do. We've taken part in a struggle which doesn't get any more serious. Mm-hmm. And because of how you may be able to handle that while you're doing it, or, you know, what happens to you in that, we combat veterans can honor ourselves in our own groups without accepting the honor of our society for doing something that the world would have been much better off had we not done. And so I don't mind, that's part of what the Marine Corps birthday party is to me. That is part of what Veterans Day is to me. On Veterans Day, I have a table of Vietnam veterans that we have been meeting for a number of years, and we're kind of wackos.
And where do you meet?
Well, it used to be non-VFW Vietnam veterans celebrating or having lunch at the VFW on Veterans Day. Uh-huh. Then one day we went and the veterans or the VFW wasn't having lunch, so we went to La Rana. And we've been at La Rana cool. ever since, and all of us enjoy La Rana. And the food's good, and they actually like us there and give us free dessert. So We've enjoyed being at Lorana.
How many Vietnam veterans do you think are combat veterans are in the Decorah area?
Well, I know that they had a thing a few years ago that I only stayed for part of, where they were doing this honor the Vietnam veterans thing. I left after a particular speaker, and so I didn't stay. But I think there are probably 50 or 60 Vietnam vets that are here. Mm-hmm. How many of them are combat vets? I don't know. Maybe half of them.
Yeah.
So.
And there's probably several hundred Iraq and Afghanistan vets, maybe more.
Well, depends on because of the reserve unit here.
Yeah. And they're scheduled to come back, I think, in a couple of months. So we hope they make it back safely.
Yeah.
What's your view? What's your recommendations to us? Things to think about. Things to do. In regards to Veterans Day, it's on the calendar. It's there. We're not going to get rid of it anytime soon, or we may not wish to. But from your experience and from your thinking that you've done, what would you recommend people like me do or think about in terms of Veterans Day?
Well, thinking about the arguments why there shouldn't be a Veterans Day. I mean, I don't think there's anything else. I mean, you know, I don't give a whole lot of thought to it, except that it's Veterans Day and I hang out with some friends of mine. That's about it for me. Veterans Day, I'm sure, after the First World War and the Second World War, unless you understood the dynamics of that and you can call into question those too. I'm not of that era, so I can't do that. So I imagine those guys that fought in the Second World War and the Korean War and whatever are probably, it's probably okay to say to those guys that you appreciate their service. You'd have to ask the Koreans about that. You know, I'm not sure what they think about it. So
yeah.
I'm sure that, there's a lot of European people that are appreciative of the fact that they aren't Nazi Germany today.
Do you have any heroes that are veterans? Because of that are heroes to you?
Because
things,
of
things they did in the service, things you saw them do. Who are some of your heroes, in or out of the military? What is a hero?
A lot of times we talk about
heroes, and part of what we do on Veterans Day, Memorial Day, is we lift up our certain veterans or all the veterans and call them heroes.
Yeah. Yeah, I grew up in a time where, I don't know, I just, maybe the Vietnam stuff, I really don't have heroes.
Dick's not even a hero? This is an inside joke,
right.
Listeners.
Not today, isn't he? Maybe tomorrow.
Okay, all right. Okay.
So.
Sorry, Dick. What role does, are you a pacifist?
No, actually, no. I think...
Help us think about...
Yeah.
Help us parse this.
Yeah. So, there is one thing that people use, which is just war theory. And I even have a problem with just war theory. And that's because we think up rules about who's supposed to be shot and who isn't, and when you can shoot someone and when you can't. And then we still... If you lay claim to this just war theory, then you can actually do things that you can honor. So I think the just war theory is probably not a good thing, because one of the things that just war theory does is it institutionalizes war, and once you institutionalize war, it basically it takes on a life of its own. And so, we're making rules about when we go to war and then how we go to war, what happens in that. I once was in a philosophy class, and 1 week we were talking about the morality of war, and the next week we were talking about the morality in war. And so the first week when we were talking about the morality of war, I said that there could not be any moral reason for war. The next week when we were talking about morality in war, I said that there can be no rules or morality in war either. What you do if you have a just war theory or a moral structure of discussing war is that you let people off the hook, mm-hmm. and they are not responsible. Mm-hmm. They are not going to get shot. Those other people are. Mm-hmm. And so they really don't care. It's lip service. They just say, thank you very much for your service when mm-hmm. you come home, mm-hmm. if you do. And so what I've done with that is said that there is no moral war. It doesn't matter. But there may be a necessary war. And so if you get some idiot that actually does get a lot of other people together and invades an innocent society, I think it may be necessary to have a war to repulse that invasion. But when you defend your kith and kin as if someone would actually come to the United States and invade us with all of our guns, I don't think that you would have to have a lot of stories or rah-rahs to get people to protect themselves and their families. And so you don't need to persuade people that you need to go to war, whether at the UN or anywhere. And so there may be a necessary war, and there may be necessary actions, but there is not a hero sense in this. They are amoral. There is no morality, so we have amoral action. It is necessary action, but it is amoral action. And so we do not honor any of those who have to take part in the war. It's just they had to do it.
How do you see the necessary discussion that you're having? And I meant that in both senses.
Yep.
Both
yep.
senses I get of the you. Word. It leads me to think about the growing regime of international law, especially the Rome Statute and the International Criminal Court, and the last 10 years of calling the so-called war on terrorism a war, mm-hmm. when it's really mm-hmm. Us trying to be incompetent mm-hmm. World policemen. Mm-hmm. And what do you think about the International Criminal Court and the fact that most of the issues now that we tend to think about in terms of preventing genocide, preventing crimes against humanity, are preventing acts of so-called terrorism, mm-hmm. Are really matters of asking whether or not there's been an international crime committed. Mm-hmm. And if so, mm-hmm. is there a way we can internationally police this mm-hmm. rather than make it a matter of state versus state war? Mm-hmm. What do you think of the International Criminal Court?
Yeah, well, actually, I think it's a good thing that the International Criminal Court is here, and I suspect that that's part of the reason that people like Bush and Cheney and Rumsfeld don't go overseas. Because I would imagine that by the criteria of the International Criminal Court, an illegal and immoral invasion of a country that never did anything wrong would probably count, and those guys should be taken to task. The easy way to do that was to give George Bush a knife and tell him to go to Iraq if he wanted to go. That's the way they used to do it. The kings would have to, you know...
lead them in.
Yeah, you would have to actually do it. On the international court, I guess I can't remember. Maybe you should say something again.
Well, the thing that we call at the Peace and Justice Center, we're anxious for the United States to go back as a signatory to the International Criminal Court. One of the things that it was negotiated during President Clinton's administration, he signed it as the executive, but it had to be ratified, and then Bush rescinded the executive's signatory, and it has yet to be ratified because the United States does not want to be held accountable internationally. It does not want to be subject to another jurisdiction. And to me, that's a fundamental issue, a fundamental obstacle to world peace, is states thinking like that. And the irony is the United States is one of the very, very few states that is still holding that position, and it's the only industrialized nation that it is.
Mm-hmm. Well, I think that we should abide by...
Did that give you enough time?
Well, I can't remember exactly what I was going to say there, but I'm sure it'll come back about 3 o'clock this morning, and I'll call
we'll
you.
We'll get you back.
I think that the United States should take part in the International Criminal Court, and we should fund and take part in the United Nations. Let me say one thing before it gets too late. I think that the military, I don't want to completely bash it. I think there's some very good things that happen in it doesn't necessarily have to do with the military, but a military type thing. I have been advocating national service with a military component.
Excellent point.
Because what the military has done, it is basically the last vestige of the melting pot. And you can see by the politics that we have today that we have no idea of how to talk to people or get along with people. In the military, you learn that from day one. You figure out how to deal with people that you never even knew existed before. The first fight I was ever saw in the barracks was an Apache Indian fighting a Pennsylvania coal miner. And the guy that broke it up was an Italian from the East Coast who got his nose broken. But it was an interesting, you know, so you have the melting pot in the military. The other thing that you have is that you work for your country. And as working for your country, you develop a sense of ownership. And when you own something, you have a responsibility towards that which is owned. It isn't keep the government out of my life, leave me alone. It's I own this country, and I want to see this country work right. Well, the military is the last vestige of that, or it was until Tricky Dick took away the draft for us. So Richard Nixon said no more draft, and now we have a volunteer army, a very small percentage of people. It's an economic volunteer army, and we don't have the society in the melting pot. We do not do stuff for our country so that we own the country and we're responsible for it. And so that is a huge thing that people of my generation who were in the age of the draft still have as a remnant of what actually made this country great.
Bob Watson, thank you very, very much.
You're welcome.
And I'm going to thank you for something today. I'm going to thank you for being you.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, it depends on which one of me shows up today.
And I also want to thank everyone who has struggled with war and peace at any level, and let us endeavor and commit to working together to be peacemakers at every level, in our homes, in our communities, in our regions, and globally. Thank you, Bob. I want to take a musical break. Bob brought with him some music that might help us chill for a few minutes, and let's hope that someday this world is a veteran and can say, we remember when, but never again. Mm-hmm. Contratopia, our local friends who really know how to pluck a string. Thank you. listening to 89.1 FM The Blend, truly independent radio, community radio, your radio from Northeast Iowa. Streaming online at 891theblend.org. Thanks again to Bob Watson for sharing some of his experiences and thoughts off the air. He was going into some of the details on the personal toll that the conflict took, including malaria and PTSD. But we'll take that up at another time, Bob. Thanks for being you. Our second guest for today is on the flip side, Christian peacemaker teams. You know, if we must lift up those who put themselves in harm's way, let's also lift up those who put themselves in harm's way in another way, who go out and put themselves at a different but connected kind of risk. Hannah Brightbill, welcome.
Thanks.
You work out at Rock Spring Farms.
Yep.
And you're originally from Nebraska, so you're Plains. We know now, us, me from Kansas, you from Nebraska, that we're not Midwest. We grew up thinking we were, but when we moved to Iowa, we found out, didn't we,
that this is the real Midwest.
This is the Midwest. Ohio. Wisconsin, Iowa, and Minnesota. That our home states are actually the Plains states. Tell us how you got involved in Christian Peacemakers, who they are, and about your specific presentation this Thursday night at 7 o'clock, that's the 10th, at the Northeast Iowa Peace and Justice Center.
Yeah. So I got involved in Christian Peacemaker teams as a young person because I grew up Mennonite, and the Mennonite Church is a peace church. And my great uncle was one of the founders of Christian Peacemaker Teams, and was the director of it for the first 15 years of its existence. So I grew up knowing about this organization. And the basic idea that got the organization started was, what if Christians devoted the same discipline and self-sacrifice to nonviolent peacemaking that soldiers devote to war? So it was a really impactful statement, saying that you can put your life on the line for peace as well as for war. So today they have teams working all around the world in zones of conflict, trying to work nonviolently with local partners who ask us in. Mm-hmm. Toward peace in some sort or another. So my trip that I'm going to be presenting on was to Northwestern Ontario, Treaty 3 territory in Ontario, and we got to learn about the things that Indigenous people are dealing with in Canada, in particular, in North America in general, and the things that they're accomplishing, and the ways that that settler people of the Americas can help.
Mm-hmm. What are some of the things you learned about the conditions there and the experiences they're having, and the issues that arise out of those experiences?
I guess a really big issue has been the economics of a community. So originally, there were Indigenous groups that had perfectly useful economies and cultures that kept everyone fed, kept everything going. They don't look at all like our settler economy that mm-hmm. was imposed on them. Mm-hmm. And so once we settlers got involved in the Americas, in Grassy Narrows, the reserve that we went to, there's been mercury poisoning in their water and logging, clear-cut logging that devastates the ecosystem on their traditional territory. And what that does is it means that their food source, their the base of their economy is no longer viable. They can't eat the fish anymore. The mammals that they used to trap are gone from the areas. That's one really important thing. They're dealing with unemployment now when they never dealt with that ever in the past. Unemployment is an entirely new concept. So that's one of the big things that I came away with thinking about.
How long were you there?
2 weeks.
And I know there are a number of projects, opportunities for connecting with not only the people there, but also elsewhere. How can people find out more about the project you worked on and about Christian Peacemaker teams in general?
The website is easy to remember. It's just cpt.org, christianpeacemakerteams.org. And there are projects in Palestine. I know that that's a hot button issue, mm-hmm. has been for a while. Projects in Colombia, again, working with local communities, kind of against multinational corporate takeover of their land. So another indigenous issue, but this time in Colombia. And there are also groups working in Iraq with Kurdish people in the north of Iraq.
What do you think will be your next project?
I'm planning on sticking with the Aboriginal Justice Team in North America for a while.
And if people come or are able to come Thursday night at 7 o'clock to the Peace and Justice Center, downtown Decorah, across the street from the Magpie, they can hear your story personally and discuss some of these things and find out how to stay connected and supportive.
Yep.
Thank you, Hannah, and we want to just take a moment to observe the serendipity that was not actually contrived, that Hannah and Bob are sitting at the same table during this hour today. And I don't know about you, but I have goosebumps. Thank you both. To close our show, we want to say thank you to a targeted underwriter, Dragonfly Books. Thank you, Dragonfly, and we are so glad that we can go to 112 West Water Street in downtown Decorah and get our book buzz on. And we invite you to the Peace and Justice Center tonight if you're not going to the playoff game or going to the reading group at Dragonfly. They are having a reading group that's starting tonight at 7 o'clock and will be the first Monday of every evening, first Monday of every month. Come down to the Peace and Justice Center. We're having our monthly meeting tonight. We do every first Monday at 7 o'clock. Thank you again to Adam, our station manager. This is being recorded. You'll be able to listen again and share it with friends at a very... before too long, by going to the site 891theblend.org. We'll close with the second track from Contratopia's 2001 recording, Hands 4, our local string aficionados. And this is Ray, the Real St. Joseph, R-E-E-L.